Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief and happy Bill of Rights Day to all of you. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting this week from Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Today, he's back. Pat Buchanan returns to State of Belief, and this time he tells us why he thinks things like diversity and equality are tearing America apart. Plus, in our Faith on Film segment, we'll get the real-life story of how a Northern European nation fought for its freedom through song. And forget Cabbage Patch Kids or Tickle Me Elmo, the hot item flying off toy shelves this holiday season is a talking Jesus doll. But first, the sudden rise of former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. Is the Republican presidential candidate headed for a great fall? Holy Huckabee. That's what splashed across the cover of the current edition of Newsweek. Polls in the caucus state of Iowa now have the Baptist minister running a double-digit lead over his nearest opponent, Mitt Romney. And unlike Romney, who's had to be cagey about his faith, Huckabee has pulled out in front specifically because he's branded himself the one true Christian conservative in the race. In fact, as the writers of the Newsweek profile put it, for Huckabee, Christian faith is not merely a talking point, it's the talking point, the basis for his claim to lead. For example, take a listen to Governor Huckabee speaking at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University when he was asked the question about how he explains his recent jump in the polls.
There's only one explanation for it, and it's not a human one. It's the same power that helped a little boy with two fish and five loaves feed a crowd of 5,000 people. And that's the only way that our campaign could be doing what it's doing.
Now, just so you're clear, I was not one of those applauding. With the bright lights of the news media focused elsewhere, Huckabee's been free to stretch the limits of campaign rhetoric while pitching himself to Christian voters. We picked up on this comment he made at the Values Voters Summit in October, even though few in the mainstream media paid any attention.
Sometimes we talk about why are we importing so many people in our workforce. It might be because for the last 35 years, we have aborted more than a million people who would have been in our workforce had we not had the Holocaust of liberalized abortion under a flawed Supreme Court ruling in 1973.
But with the lead position in the important state of Iowa, the scrutiny on Huckabee has increased. His opponents for the Republican nomination are making more pointed attacks against his campaign. News outlets are covering Huckabee's track record from his days as Arkansas governor, including his role in releasing a violent criminal who later committed fatal crimes. AIDS activists are pointing to a statement Huckabee made 15 years ago calling for the quarantine of those stricken with the disease. And just this past week, he had to apologize for a remark he made to the New York Times when he asked, "Don't Mormons believe that Jesus and the devil are brothers?" Amidst the increasing chatter, one group has been noticeably quiet, the Democrats. And this past week, sources within the Democratic National Committee revealed that party staffers have been told to hold their fire on Huckabee. One anonymous staffer, in fact, was quoted as saying that Huckabee will be an easy kill in the general election. So in Huckabee's case, will the question of Job prove true that God giveth and God taketh away? Will the very thing that pushed Huckabee to the front of the race, his outspoken Christian faith, be his undoing in the race for the White House? Joining us now to discuss how this may play out is a voice familiar to many Air America listeners. David Benders, a political activist and longtime advisor on many Democratic political campaigns. He's also a former Air America radio host. And David joins us right now on the road in Austin, Texas. David Bender, welcome to State of Believe.
Pleasure to be here.
Now tell me, do you think the Republican Party is really worried about Huckabee becoming a nominee?
Both have reasons to be hopeful and to be concerned, it seems to me. I should say I spent 4 years ago right now in the snows of Iowa with Howard Dean. And a lot of people have compared the Huckabee boom to what happened to Howard Dean, and potentially with the same result, that it was a meteoric rise and it'll be an equally dramatic fall. We haven't seen how this is going to play out yet. But I think one of the things that differentiates Mike Huckabee from Howard Dean is that Huckabee, no matter what is thrown at him, he has maintained so far an amazing demeanor of calm, a sense of self-deprecatory humor, a quality of candor. Whether it's genuine candor or not is you know open for others to analyze, but he comes across as being open. For Howard Dean, and I watched this close up, it was death by a thousand cuts, Welton. He was, each new criticism seemed to make him a little more beleaguered, and we're not seeing that with Huckabee. So the issue is, does Huckabee have a glass jaw because of his record? And I can tell you only in this initial going, we're seeing as a candidate, he shows an enormous amount of poise under pressure. The one thing I would say is when we talk about this easy kill, they said the same thing about another governor of Arkansas, named a two-term president named Clinton. He's going to go into the general election with the draft and with I didn't inhale and with Jennifer Flowers and all the rest. And turns out he wasn't that easy a kill.
So how would you go at critiquing Huckabee? Because the Democrats can't just complain about his use of religious rhetoric. Many of them are using religious rhetoric as well. So what do you see as a vulnerable place here?
Well, if you take the Karl Rove playbook, you do attack someone at their strength. I do think, however, it's going to be his record that's going to be the issue for people. And whether or not it's the issue of the parole for the man who went out and committed another crime. And, see, that does connect in Welton to the question of whether or not his religious faith, which he is the first to say, informs him to his core in terms of what he does as a person and as a politician. But if it turns out that it was faith which colored his judgment in terms of recommending this parole, that becomes an issue. And that belies his statement that, he can make a distinction between the public square and his personal faith.
David, he has talked about a theocratic war, a war between Christians and Muslims in Iraq. I mean, that's pretty potent rhetoric.
Well, he's talked about reclaiming this country for Christ.
Yeah. So are people going to put up with that?
I think Republican voters, and we're seeing this in Iowa, certainly are embracing it. Now, Is it a majority? Is it a significant plurality? Is it enough to win the nomination? It's still too early to tell if he can continue. But in the early run-up, and I have to tell you that 8-9 months ago, when no one had heard of Mike Huckabee, I was telling people, told them on my show, this is the guy to watch. And he has the personal qualities. You got to remember, I'm a Californian. I watched Ronald Reagan do this. And a lot of it is not what he says, but how he says it. Mm-hmm. And he's very effective.
Hmm. You're usually informing Democratic candidates. I'm going to ask you to play the role for a second of informing Huckabee. What would you tell him to do to keep his popularity up?
I would tell him to do exactly what he is doing now. I would tell him to, add some staff so that he gets a little better. He needs to increase his bona fides on foreign policy. He needs to not be caught up in moments where he didn't know that the National Intelligence Estimate had been released. Those things can't happen because those are gaffes, as we get onto a bigger stage. But frankly, I would say do exactly what you're doing now. Do not let people reinvent you. Do not, I see little danger of that happening. He is very self-directed. He's very poised. And if he doesn't lose his equilibrium, he doesn't start getting too handled. And I suppose if I were a Republican advisor, I'd say don't listen to people like me. Trust your instincts because they've been very good.
David Bender has been our guest. If you miss hearing his voice on Air America, and I know many of you do, you can catch him regularly on The Rachel Maddow Show. David, it's great to have you with us on State of Belief. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Look forward to coming back anytime.
Still to come, Pat Buchanan says we're on a path to national suicide. But will I be able to talk Pat off his ledge? Also, while a real war continues with no end in sight, why do some members of Congress continue to spend time and resources fighting the so-called war on Christmas? But up next, a film that shows how the power of song saved a nation and liberated its people. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
State of Belief journeys behind the camera lens to get a look at faith on film.
This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. The desire for independence from oppressive forces has prompted revolution throughout history. The goal of freedom has often been achieved at a high cost of lives lost and societies broken. But in the 1980s, the people of the small northern European nation Estonia did not fight a revolution, they sang it.
It was an extraordinary show of mass defiance in the Baltic region of the Soviet Union.
This singing together, this was our power.
If 20,000 people start to sing one song, then you just cannot shut them up. It's impossible.
This year's long demonstration of nonviolent resistance against the Soviets has become known as the Singing Revolution, and it's explored in a new documentary by the same name. The Singing Revolution is being called a story about how a culture-based protest saved a nation. Jim Tusty is the director of the Singing Revolution, and he joins us now by phone to tell us more about the film. Jim, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you very much, Reverend Gaddy.
Please explain to our listeners what the Singing Revolution is.
Well, it's an amazing story. It essentially is the story of David defeating Goliath without even using a slingshot. The small country of Estonia, under the harshest, most oppressive of conditions and occupation by the Soviet Union, was essentially able to sing itself free, as incredulous as that may sound. But what the Estonians did was they would do things like have 300,000 people stand in an open field and sing forbidden songs under the eyes of Soviet police, and was just too many people to throw in jail. Or they had 1 million people, along with Latvians and Lithuanians, hold hands in an unbroken chain of people for 600 kilometers from Estonia to Lithuania in protest of the Soviet Union. And the last example I'll give is they actually had about 90% of the adult Estonians sign a petition while they were under Soviet rule, saying that they considered the Soviet occupation of Estonia illegal under international law and that they considered themselves citizens of the Estonian Republic. And it was just too many people for Gorbachev or the Soviet Union to throw in jail.
My goodness. I want to ask who sang first, but I guess the better question is, how did it start? Whose idea was it?
Well, who sang first goes back to time immemorial. The Estonians have a long, long history of singing, and it's part of their culture, which is part of how made this nonviolent revolution work in that particular country. The Estonians have been on the land for anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 years, making them one of the oldest inhabited lands on the planet. And music has been a part of Estonian life for at least centuries and probably millennia. And Estonia, as small a country as it is, has one of the largest collections of folk songs in the world. And so it was very natural for the Estonians to use singing essentially as a weapon. And when Stalin came in the 1940s, the Estonians even composed a song that was based upon a 100-year-old national poem. And the beauty of that strategy was the Estonians could sing the songs and know that it really meant a free Estonia, but the Soviet censors didn't get it because they knew nothing about Estonian poems of 100 years earlier. So The Estonians used singing as essentially a kind of quiet civil disobedience for the entire time they were occupied.
What made you want to immortalize this story in film?
Well, truth in broadcasting here, my father was born in Estonia. And so I knew about Estonia my whole life, although he married an American woman, and therefore I did not have a particularly strong Estonian upbringing in the United States. I grew up in New York City. But because of that connection, my wife and I were engaged to teach a filmmaking course in Tallinn, Estonia in 1999. And in the course of teaching that program, we started hearing stories about the singing revolution. These were incredibly brave people who literally would stand as human shields protecting a TV station from Soviet tanks. But beyond the bravery of the acts, we were equally amazed that we had never heard of it. And as we talked to our friends in the States and in Europe, we essentially discovered that no one had really heard of this. It was a very unknown event. And we just decided we were in the right place at the right time. The story spoke to us. It touched us. And we decided to make a film about it.
What do you want to be the lasting impact of this story? What's its relevance for our society?
Probably the central theme in my mind. You know, the story takes place in Estonia, but it's a story about humankind. It transcends the Estonian nation. And I think the story is how there is an irrepressible desire for self-control and self-determination in all humans, that under the harshest of conditions, which range from Stalin in 1940 executing people, sending people to Siberia, 25% of the Estonian population was lost in 6 years. It was that horrible. It still could not squash the desire for self-control over one's own country. And maybe even more amazingly, though, is after 3 or 4 generations of Soviet education, go 50 years later when the repressions are not as bad as under Stalin, even after 4 generations of children being raised in a Soviet school system, they still could not squelch the desire for self-control of the Estonian people. And I think that is something we all hold. It's as simple as, I don't want my neighbor telling me what color to paint my living room. Let's get out of the world of politics. It's this individual drive for people to control their own lives, which we believe is universal.
What a remarkable story. Jim Tusty is the director of The Singing Revolution. The film's now playing in New York City. It opens in other parts of the country next month. Go to singingrevolution.com to see when it's coming to your area. Jim Tusty, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, Pat Buchanan says it's time for America to put America first. But do we need to do so at the expense of religious and ethnic diversity? Pat says yes. I think you know what I say. We'll talk about it. Next, I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Our next guest sure seems to get himself in a lot of disagreements. When he was on this show last year, he and I disagreed about the role religion plays in the debate over illegal immigration. And practically every Sunday, you can see him disagreeing with his fellow panelists on the McLaughlin Group. You could say that disagreements are Pat Buchanan's stock in trade. But take a listen to this little back and forth between Buchanan and panel member Lawrence O'Donnell from McLaughlin last Sunday. While discussing Mitt Romney's speech on faith, Buchanan remains reasonable and even enlightening while, well, O'Donnell just becomes unhinged.
He believes, if he believes the faith of his fathers, that black people are black because in heaven they turned away from God. In this demented Scientology-like notion of what was going on in heaven before the creation of the earth.
Mormonism disqualifies him from being president.
I'm saying he's got to answer. When he was 30 years old, how about the faith of his great-grandfather who had 5 wives?
Well, my great-grandfather had slaves. And I don't believe in slavery.
Well, there lies the paradox of Pat Buchanan. You find yourself agreeing with him and then disagreeing with him on the same subject at the same time. Perhaps that's why he's such a prolific character in the conservative movement. Many of his ideas have spawned massive arguments, but the quality of his reasoning and logic ensures that these arguments are never dismissed lightly. The title of Pat Buchanan's new book is not to be dismissed lightly either. It's called Day of Reckoning: How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. What does Pat think is causing this alleged erosion of our nation's principles, and what are his solutions to mending the problem? Pat Buchanan joins us now by phone from his home in Virginia. Pat, welcome back to State of Belief.
Well, thank you very much.
Pat, let's start at the end rather than the beginning. Your last words in the book are these: our day of reckoning is at hand, time to mind our own business, time to lay down the burden and come home, time to put America first. Is that an intentional overstatement, or is that your feeling about our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan and a whole lot more?
Well, with regard to Iraq, I felt we should never go in. I said at the time when everybody was, the very day Baghdad fell, everyone said this is phenomenal. It's like we're in Berlin. It's like taking over Tokyo. I said, I think we've hit the tar baby. Once having done that, having invaded and occupied this country and destroyed the state, the government, the army, you can't turn around and walk away and leave a humanitarian catastrophe and strategic disaster. Mm-hmm. So I don't disagree with the Bush's policy of trying to put something together and leave it standing as we depart. Afghanistan, I think we did the right thing going in and knocking over the regime and then chasing the Al-Qaeda all the way to Tora Bora, and I regret that we didn't get the lot of them. I have my skepticism about whether we're going to be able to build a democratic, enduring nation in a country whose politics are rooted in Islamic faith.
This show is called State of Belief, so you would expect me to ask a question like this. What are the religious underpinnings of your view on America's decline?
We have forgotten God. In the United States, I think we were a predominantly, overwhelmingly Christian nation. I would say 95% Christian as of 1960. Now, part of it was nominally Christian, but we had Christian, not only was it Christian in terms of its church going, but in terms of its beliefs, its culture, and the basis of its laws. After that, we went through a cultural revolution, much like the French Revolution, but ours was nonviolent. But it turned values upside down. It turned beliefs upside down. So we went through this in our views not only of what is morally right and morally wrong, but whether God exists, whether our lives end with this earth, whether America is a great and good country, whether the West is a great civilization, or whether we're really the instigators of the progenitors of slavery and genocide and racism, sexism, colonialism, imperialism, as some people believe, this cultural war divided us on all of the issues on which we were once united. And I think that is what has torn us apart, what has destroyed the family, which is some of the causes, one of the primary causes, in my judgment, of the decomposition of society.
But, Pat, I don't understand the connecting the dots between the illustrations that you used initially about America's decline and trying to be far-flung in our kind of imperial approach to the world,
right,
and then just a national recognition of God. I mean, personally, I don't think that a pluralism of Christians in the nation makes a Christian nation. I think we're a democratic nation.
Right.
But what's the connection between this far-flung empire that
empire,
you're calling us to move away from?
As I say, we have a perfect storm of crises. They all don't proceed from the same root. I think the decomposition of the family and of the character of the people is in decline, and I think that's directly related to the basically de-Christianization of America and the secularization of America. The empire consists, the reason we are building the present empire or advancing it is under a new dogma, which is a post-Christian dogma of salvation through democracy alone. And that dogma, under that dogma, unless the whole world becomes democratic, we can never be secure and free. Now, this is democratism. This is the ideology that President Bush embraced between the 9/11 and the Axis of Evil speech. And this is what took him and us into Iraq, the greatest blunder, I think, in American diplomatic history. And this is what is propelling him into this messianic view that the whole world's got to be converted to democracy or we can't be secure.
And if I understand correctly, reading your book, you're saying that terrorism, which is such a big subject today, is the price of empire.
Sure it is. The British were terrorized in Palestine because they were there. The French were terrorized in Algiers because they were there. And the Americans were hit on 9/11 because we were over there. They were over here because we are over there. That is the way weak peoples and desperate peoples drive out invading armies, or what they perceive as invading imperial armies. And if we get all our troops home, that may not end terror, but a lot of people all over the world will say, now we got to deal with our own problems. And then why would they come over here and kill us then? Just for the pleasure of it?
Well, now, Pat, I have to say, I think that your chapter on the Gospel of Bush, you're about as hard on President Bush as I've read or heard anybody being. What is the source of his arrogant aggressiveness in seeking to fit the world into an American vision of democracy? Is he confusing ideology and theology?
Yes, very well put. First, there is hubris, and that is sort of an arrogance of power. The president came to office with good intentions, and he came in and he said, look, we got to have a humble foreign policy. We can't get into nation building. We don't have the ability to do that, and there's no necessity for us to do it. And we don't have the resources to turn the whole world and make it all American. But what happened was that the neoconservatives, as they're called, they don't want to give up power, and they think the United States is now the first nation on earth. It's our opportunity to basically impose our vision on mankind. They detest many of the Arab autocracies, which are not attractive. They're extremely pro-Israel, and they want us to smash all those countries or their regimes and overthrow them all. After 9/11, they were calling for attacks on 15 or so countries. And what Bush did is Bush was converted to this. This belief that is Islamo-fascism, whatever they call it now, he was even using the term till he dropped it, that we have to go after Iran, we got to go after Iraq and Syria, and we got to go after them all. They will rise up and they will all, you know, they will all emulate the United States and they all love freedom. They don't. He doesn't understand the people. He doesn't understand history. He doesn't understand human nature. He is possessed of an ideology which is as hardcore as Marxism. The Marxists, I don't care what happened, they keep banging their head against the wall saying we can make it work if only we get the formula right. But they were wrong. The system doesn't work.
So is this Bush ambition or is this Bush religion?
This is quasi-religion and ambition combined. Bush was told he would be the Churchill of his generation. You know, it's a cakewalk war, sir. Just go up there. It will come down. They will welcome us with flowers. Cheney told him, I think we're going to be welcome. You know, it's going to be like Paris, 1944. And then the Iranian people will see how free the Iraqis are. They will rise up and overthrow the mullahs, and the Syrians will overthrow Bashir. And then the Palestinians will say, well, we've got no choice but make peace with the Israelis. He doesn't understand human nature. And he bought a bill of goods. It's like Woodrow Wilson. We're going to go over and make the world safe for democracy. And we wound up making it safe for Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, Lenin, Trotsky.
Of the candidates that you see in both parties offering themselves for the presidency, who gets your message? Who do you trust to get the nation back on course?
I don't think we're going to get back on course until the crises come. Do I think they're going to get a hold of it? Do I think if they get in there, they're really going to do it? Do I think they agree with me about the urgency of the issues and they're as aware of them as I am? No, I don't. You know, I think a lot of what I've said has come true. And I think this is going to come true.
Well, let me ask you this, because you've said that the source of decline is forgetting God, that we moved to secularism rather than Christianity. Do you want a president who leads the nation back to God and advocates Christianity as a national religion?
Well, I look, would I like to see a devout Christian as president of the United States? The answer is yes. I would also like to see a president who is a conservative, who understands these issues as I'm talking about them. I would also like to see a president who is competent and tough and decisive as and a strong leader. I'd also like to see one who can communicate like Reagan. You cannot get all of these things in your candidate. You got to pick the closest approximation you can get to it. And I haven't made a decision. I haven't endorsed because I don't feel, I don't feel I should get into this. I've had my shot at it, and there are a lot of people in there I like, and they're giving it their best shot, and maybe they're not doing well, but they deserve not to have me come out and endorse somebody else.
I have one last question for you, and it's a quick one, but an important one. I know something of your schedule. I mean, you've been doing interviews all day. You write books. You speak here and there. What drives you? Why do you do all this?
Well, I feel, you know, it's a vocation. It is a vocation, just like the priesthood is a vocation for some. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this since, I don't know, since 1962. I was at a newspaper, and there was an opening on the editorial page. I was there a couple of weeks, and I went right back and applied for it. I didn't want to be a reporter. I wanted to write editorials, and I wanted to speak my views about what I felt about how the country was going. And initially, I guess it was the Cold War was the main motivating factor. And now it's the country, and now it's what's happening. Kiesler had a good line. Of course, he's the fellow that wrote The God That Failed about communism. He was a communist. And he said, if you're given a podium, or you're given a platform, or you're given a voice, a man ought to speak what he believes to be the truth, or shut up. And I think that's a good motto.
Pat Buchanan's new book is titled Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. Agree with him or disagree with him, he's always an interesting conversation and prods thoughts. Pat, thank you for having this discussion with me here on State of Belief.
Well, thank you.
You're a mean one, Mr. Green.
Coming up, just in case you've forgotten, some members of Congress desperately want to remind you that there is a war on Christmas. We'll tell you how they're spending government time and money to fight on the front lines. And the talking Jesus doll. More on that in just a few minutes. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
Monster, Mr. Grinch. Your heart's an empty hole. Your brain is full of spiders.
This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. And every year, it seems, we have to start rolling our eyes when we enter the month of December. As commentators with agendas to fill and religious leaders with sermons to write begin telling us of the revived war on Christmas. Now, usually, this type of rhetoric doesn't go much farther than a segment on Bill O'Reilly's nightly show complaining about store clerks saying Happy Holidays rather than Merry Christmas, or maybe by a sermon by an angry pastor. Those of us who understand that there is no such war on Christmas are hardly inconvenienced by these people, who most certainly have the right to discuss any perceived culture war they believe is going on in our nation. But what about when these fights are taken up by our elected representatives? That's what happened last week in the Capitol building. Republican Congressman Steve King of Iowa introduced a House resolution, and I'm quoting here, recognizing the importance of Christmas and the Christian faith. Are we serious here? Is this really what we want our government spending its time and money on? Look, I'm a Christian. I think it's safe to say the United States has a stellar track record when it comes to recognizing the importance of Christmas and the Christian faith. In fact, we're so good at it that we often do that at the expense of other faiths and their traditional celebrations. But here's the kicker. The resolution actually came to a vote and was passed by the House on a vote of 372-9. More Democrats voted for the bill than did Republicans. What a boost for right-wing organizations using a war on Christmas to raise money. Come on, folks. We have enough to worry about with a real war in which people are dying, a real war that needs to be ended. And may I remind you, that too is Christian, that too is about the highest values of religion. And while we're on the subject of the war on Christmas, I wonder what the people who are so busy fighting it would say about this next item. The most popular toy being sold at Walmart stores this year is not the new Nintendo machine or a Disney character. It's a 12-inch talking Jesus doll. The superstore says it sold out of the doll at all locations. The doll was also being sold online through Target, which also has sold out of the Bible-quoting toy. Now, since one of the battle tactics in fighting the war on Christmas, according to Christian Ethics Today, is de-emphasizing commercialism during the Christmas season, I wonder how the mass selling of a talking doll, not unlike a Tickle Me Elmo, fits in with the mission of ending Christmas commercialism. Or maybe I'm just being a Grinch. Well, that's our show for this week. If you want to respond to anything you heard today, or if you want to call me a Grinch personally, go to the Contact Us page at stateofbelief.com and send us an email. Or call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. And if you've missed any part of this show or want to hear past shows, you can download them at stateofbelief.com. Head over to the site and sign up to make our free show archives available to you. All you need is an email address, so what are you waiting for? Get moving. State of Belief is produced by the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Members of the Interfaith Alliance make this show possible. So if you like what you've heard, think about becoming a member of the Interfaith Alliance yourself. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Next week, a quest to find meaning in religion took two brothers around the globe and put them in front of 12 of the world's most influential spiritual leaders. We'll find out about their journey. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.